ברוכים הבאים. שיעור תראי לעילו נשמת שרה בת בהיה. רוח השם תניחנה בגן עדן, אמן. We are studying פרשת ויגש. A parasha, of course, is very dramatic. It is when Yosef reveals himself to the brothers, when he says, Ani Yosef. As a result, Yaakov is made aware that Yosef is alive, physically and spiritually. He's living in Egypt. He's the viceroy. Yaakov Abinu alav ha-shalom now needs to prepare to bring his whole family down to Egypt, to Mitzrayim. Of course, that would begin the Galut. Galut Mitzrayim, the first exile, or the first official exile of the Jewish people. Yaakov Abinu alav ha-shalom makes some preparations before he goes down. I would like to discuss those preparations. The Pasuk writes in Perek Mem Vav, in Pasuk Chaf Het, Ve'et Yehuda shalach lefanav el Yosef, lehorot lefanav Goshna, ve'yavohu arsa Goshna. Yaakov Abinu sends his son Yehuda to the city of Goshen. Rashi, of course, tells us why he did that. Rashi tells us to establish a Bet Midrash. Kodem shiyagia lesham. Before anybody gets there, Yaakov Abinu will not go into a city that doesn't have a yeshiva. Yehuda is a Rosh Yeshiva, so he sends them there to establish a place of learning. Shemisham tetze hora'ah. From there they'll have rulings and understanding. And the city that Yaakov Abinu establishes, this yeshiva, is the city of Goshen. I'm not an expert in grammar. However, when I see the word Goshna, Goshna actually means Le Goshen, to Goshen. In grade school, they taught us a grammatical rule that says that whenever you have a he at the end of the word, it replaces a lamed that could have been in the beginning of the word. So I could say, I am going le New York. Or I could say, New Yorka. New Yorka is le New York. That's as much as I know about that grammatical rule. But I have a big question, why do they use this rule in this case? I mean, for the same money, you could have wrote that he went Legoshen. But instead the Torah decides to say, oh, grammatical rule, Goshna. Okay, it's the same thing. But I have a right to ask why the Torah would choose to invoke that grammatical rule here. Especially that it's not any extra letters. It's either a lamed or a heh. So it's not like you say, oh, this is cheaper to write it this way. It's not any cheaper. It's not any more economical. It's the same amount of letters. That's the question that I had. To my delight, I found that actually this question is discussed at length by a great rabbi called B'nai Yisachar. He goes on to discuss very, very deep and important principles that still have application. He talks about the four exiles. We know the four exiles. It started with Babel, and then we had Parasumadai, and of course Yavan, which we just celebrated, Hanukkah, and then of course you have Edom, or some people call it Romi, because it's the Romans that started this last exile, Galut Romi. And he says, that those four exiles are actually children of the mother of all exiles. The mother of all exiles, of course, is Mitzrayim. You see, we don't count Mitzrayim as one of the four. The four exiles start with Bavel. Because all that would happen to Klal Yisrael in the future starts already in Galut Mitzrayim. That's the protoplasm. That's the gene. That's the shoresh. That's the root. He actually gives a remez. If you look in the Sefer Shemot, in Perek Bet, in Pasuk Chav Gimel, I have it here, in Perek Bet, Pasuk Chav Gimel, so the Pasuk writes, and I quote, Vayi bayamim harabim ahem. It was in those days, those many days, Vayamot melech Mitzrayim, Vayanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avodah. It talks about how the Jewish people were crying, groaned because of the work. This is when the exile started. And it calls the days Yamim Harabim, the many days. So says the B'nai Yisrael, that if you take the word Rabim, Rabim is Rashi Tevot. The Resh stands for Romi. And the Bet stands for Bavel, and the Yud stands for Yavan, and the Mem stands for Madai, in Parasu Madai. So Vayhi Bayamim Arabim, there would be Vayhi. Anytime the Torah talks about Vayhi, Vayhi Lashon Sa'ar. The word Vayhi is like Vay, Hai, Whoa, Ho. So the Pasuk is predicting that what happened in Egypt would happen four more times. Vayhi, there would be Woe. When would there be woe? Bayamim harabim. In the exiles that are hinted in Rabim. Good news is that if Egypt is the paradigm, so Baruch Hashem, there was Yitziat Mitzrayim. Well, that's good news. Because if there's Yitziat Mitzrayim, if we left Egypt, that means we're going to leave the final exile as well. You can't just tell me that, oh, Egypt represents that there's going to be four exiles of trouble. But you have to finish the story. We came out of Egypt. There was Yitziat Mitzrayim. So therefore there's going to be Yitziat, well, Bavel is over, Paras u'Madai is over, Yavan is over, so there'll be Yitziat Romi, Yitziat Edom. That's probably why we make such a big deal in our religion always of commemorating Yitziat Mitzrayim, Yitziat Mitzrayim. Why are we making such a big deal? It's history. It passed already. The reason why we make such a big deal of it is because as long as we can remember that there's going to be Yitziat Mitzrayim, that gives us hope and anticipation that there'll be a redemption to this long, seemingly endless, at least the way it feels, galut that we're in. So that's a nehamah, it's a comforting mitzvah. When you hear Yitziat Mitzrayim, you say to yourself, ah, Baruch Hashem. There's Yitziat Mitzrayim, there's also going to be Yitziat Galut Edom, or Galut Romi. He then goes on to explain that each Galut has its own has its own unique characteristic. Like the Gemara would say, Lor izeh ken izeh, velor izeh ken izeh. This is not like this one, and this one is not like that one. Each one has its own properties. And he explains. He says, Galut Bavel, they were the first ones that dared. They didn't only dare, they actually, they made it through to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. Who could believe the Beit HaMikdash that King Solomon built? And they came along and they destroyed it. They razed it to the ground. The Beit HaMikdash, when it existed, was the greatest place for a person to go to if he was interested in what we call Tikkun HaNefesh. You know, when a person wants to make a rectification to his soul, he made sins. In the olden days, there was a way to fix it. You went, you brought a korban, the kohen put his hands on the head of the animal, they slaughtered it, you watched it. That's Korban Chatat. That's Korban Ola. All these sins, by the time you left the Beit HaMikdash, you made your tikkun. They took away tikkun ha-nefesh. As a result, after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed by the Babylonians, Klal Yisrael was in galut nefesh. If you look in the Torah in Vayikra, many times when the Torah talks about a person bringing a korban, it says v'nefesh ki takriv. It uses that word because it's that part of the human being that comes to be rectified in the Beit HaMikdash. And once they destroyed the temple, galut nefesh. Well, after that, you had the galut of Paras u'Madai. Now, Paras u'Madai, they were actually coming after our bodies. Haman. There was no temple. They couldn't destroy the temple. There was no temple. But there were still Jews around. And Haman vowed Lahashmid, Laharog, Ul'abed, et kol ha-Yehudim. Menar va'ad zaken, tafe nashim b'yom echad. In one day, his plan was to commit a genocide. What Hitler Yemach Shemo took 4 or 5 years to do, Haman HaRasha wanted to accomplish in one day. And as a result, there would be no more Klal Yisrael. He went after our bodies. Well, the human body is called Guf. So therefore we would call the Galut of Paras u'Madai Galut HaGuf, where the human body, the Jewish body, was in peril. Then came the Greeks. Now the Greeks, they didn't destroy the temple, as you know. They might have contaminated it and, you know, ransacked it, but they didn't destroy it, so you can't call them Galut HaNefesh. You really can't call them Galut HaGuf either. We don't see anywhere that the Greeks were actually coming to kill Jews. Now they might have killed Jews, but that's not what their intent was. Nor can we characterize them either as Galut HaGuf. Their attack was against the Jewish mind. Like we said in the Al-Nisim in Amidah, I'm sure you ladies said it as well. Their intention was l'shakeham toratach, to cause us to forget our Torah. Of course, Torah is in the brain. That's where the Sechel Yehudi. And they introduced foreign ideas, philosophy, Greek philosophy. They introduced Greek music, Greek poetry. Greeks are atheists. They believe in many gods, but not the God that we believe in, obviously. They introduced that as well. They actually translated the Torah into Greek. So they tried to reinterpret our Torah. So actually, they actually got into the brains of Klal Yisrael. I'm sorry to tell you that most of the Jewish people became secularized. Those were called the Mityavnim, the Hellenists. The Ramban writes that the Jewish people came this close. For those of you that are listening, I'm putting my fingers very close to each other. But those that can see me, they came this close. Shehash v'shalom, Ramban says, Nishtakeha Torah miYisrael. The Torah would have been forgotten from the Jewish people, were it not for the Hashmonaim. So that galut he refers to as galut ha-sechel, that they went after the sechel. And now he gets to our exile. Our exile is the longest, and it's actually all encompassing. It includes everything. You see, our exile began when the Romans destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. That's a repeat to what the Babylonians did. Galut Romi begins with Galut HaNefesh. They destroyed the temple. They did the same thing that the Babylonians did. I don't have to tell you, if you look at this long exile, they have come against our bodies as well. The most recent example would be the Hurban of European Jewry. Clearly they were coming after our bodies. Hitler was not coming after our religion. He didn't only kill religious Jews. He killed Jews that were biologically Jewish. He didn't care our observance. That's the grandson of Haman. So we experienced once again Galut Aguf in this exile. And it goes without saying that up until today, although maybe Galut Aguf has lightened up, Galut HaNefesh is behind us. However, Galut HaSechel still applies. In exile, we are subject to the ideology of the Goyim, to the thinking of the Goyim. In our country, we have to tolerate the liberal thinking, the different things that American society tolerates, things that are clearly run against what we believe as Torah Jews, but that becomes very pervasive in society. You know, what is considered normal in American society, sometimes the Torah will call perverted, or something that's abominable. And we have to tolerate these different ideas. That's one thing, besides the atheistic views of how the world came about, the way it's taught in universities, the revolution, and all sorts of godless theories. We have to contend with that as well. Clearly, there is an attack against the Jewish sechel. Even in Judaism itself, you have reform and conservative. These are liberal forms that have perverted the sechel of Yehudim. So actually, this galut is type O blood. It's universal. It has everything. Hence, he calls this galut, galut hakol. It's the galut of everything. It's, you know, it's an everything bagel. It has everything in it. Galut hakol. So the rabbi comes along and says that Yaakov Abinu alav shalom, when he came down to Egypt, he knew that he wasn't just coming down to Egypt. He knew that Egypt is the mother of all exiles, and he knew that he was going to come down, or his children would actually come down as a result of Egypt to four additional exiles. Vehi bayamim harabim. And therefore, when he went down, the Torah alludes to us that he had this kavanah. So the pasuk comes and says that he didn't go legoshen. It says he went goshna. Goshna rashi tevot, gimal is for guf. The sheen is for sechem. The nun is for nefesh. And the he is hakol. And therefore, Yaakov Abinu, his first destination when he goes down to Egypt, he goes Goshna, in order to allude that that's going to be the children of this Galut, and therefore the Jews are going to have to endure Galut HaGuf, Galut HaSechet, Galut HaNefesh, and as we are enduring now, Galut HaKol. That is the theory that he proposes. Of course, it's very fascinating, and you see that the word is very, very precise. So I would like to offer yet maybe another interpretation why the Torah used that word, Goshna. Our Hachamim tell us that Yaakov Abinu alav shalom was actually the first one of the avot that built a home with children. We call it Bet Yaakov. I know Avraham, but he had one child, the other one he threw out. Yitzhak Abinu the same. Esav was eventually thrown out, or Yaakov had to leave. But the one that establishes the house of Jacob, the house of Israel, is Yaakov Avinu. After all, he has the twelve Shebatim. So if anybody is going to give us a lesson in how to build a Jewish home, which all of you should be concerned about, how do you build a Jewish home? So you have to go to Yaakov Avinu for counsel, for advice. After all, he's the one that established the first official Jewish home in history. Matter of fact, I say Jewish home because Yaakov's children are called Bnei Yisrael. The children of Yisrael, he's Yisrael. And he clearly succeeded. Well, you do see two examples of what I think is the key to the house of Yaakov Avinu. A few weeks ago we read that he left his father-in-law's house, Laban's house. I always wondered, how did Yaakov Avinu live with Laban? For more than 10 years, for over 20 years, 22 years. I mean, Laban is the biggest Rasha. Laban is the father or the teacher of Esav. I mean, Laban is Oved Avodah Zarah. And whatever Yaakov Avinu stands for, Laban is the opposite. And here, for Yaakov Avinu to live with Laban for 22 years, how come it didn't have an effect on him? Although he says, Im Laban garti, Taryag mitzvot shamarti, I kept the Taryag mitzvot, I want to know how, what's the trick? I know the answer, ladies. The answer is found in Sefer Hasidim by the Biuda Hasid. It's actually in, he gives different tidbits of Hiddushim and he numbers them. This is a number 800, no, actually it's in 1157. Taf, Taf, Shin, Nun, Zayin. And he writes, En likanes bebet avodah zarah. If there's a place of avodah zarah, you shouldn't enter it. And then he writes, Uma shehaya Yaakov bebet Laban. Are you going to ask me, Yaakov Avinu lived in Bet Laban, and clearly that's not a good home? Lo haya nichnas be'aholo. He never went into Laban's house. Do you believe this? He never went in, not on a Friday night, not on Hanukkah, not on Veterans Day. He never went in to borrow eggs. He never went in to get a pencil. He never went in to say Happy Father's Day to Laban. Never walked into the guy's house. Could you believe it? You're living with Laban for 22 years. And if he didn't walk into the house, that means his children didn't walk into the house either. That means Yaakov Avinu kept his family insulated and protected and separated from the negative influence. Now clearly, it's much easier if you're not living next door to Laban to do this. So Yaakov Avinu had a great challenge. That you have this Yetzer Hara right next door to you, and he put a ban. We're not allowed to walk into the guy's house. Because he knows that once you walk into the house, Laban presents assimilation. Laban presents all sorts of trouble to the family of Yaakov. Wow, he just says it in one line. But I cannot imagine the challenges of not walking into Laban's house for 22 years. And that's why when he makes his statement, Im Laban Garti, he doesn't mean Garti, meaning I lived in his house. He said, no, the rabbi said, no, Garti is not Garti. Garti is Taryag. They changed the word Garti. I didn't learn from his bad ways. You know why? Because I never walked into the guy's house. So Yaakov Avinu's interaction with Laban is very, you know, unless he sees him at a bus stop, but he doesn't have any interaction with him on his turf, on his territory, which I think is a key. The key in raising a Jewish home is separation. Or insulation to a certain degree. I know we don't live, we don't live in a bubble. But insulation is good when it comes to this, especially in a toxic society like we're living in. I have another proof of the method of Yaakov Avinu. So he runs away from his father-in-law with all his children. He said, we got to get out of here. He realized that it's time to leave. Hashem told me he has to go. Laban runs after him. Of course, Laban's a liar. Laban says, where are you? Why did you run away? I wanted to make a going away party. I would have had an orchestra. We would have made a sa'udah. You robbed me from sending you off, you know, bon voyage. So, They say to themselves, let's make a treaty amongst ourselves. Let's make a peace treaty. Now, normally, how do you make a peace treaty? You sign a document, you shake hands, you take some pictures, you hug each other, and now there's peace. This is a very, very odd treaty that they made. The pasuk comes along and says, "Ve'ata lecha nechreta berit, ani ve'ata." Let's make a berit, a covenant. Vayikar Yaakov Evan, so he takes a rock. Vayinimeha matzeva, and he builds a matzeva, a monument is the right word, ladies. Vayomer Yaakov le'ehav, he tells his children, liktu avanim. Everybody pick up a stone. Vayikru avanim, vayasu gal. And then they build a mound made out of rocks. This is a very strange peace treaty. When I was in elementary school, they made us watch the treaty that Menachem Begin signed with Sadat, and Kara was in the middle. That's the way I always understood how a peace treaty is supposed to look. You know, they're shaking hands, they're smiling at each other, they're all sitting at the same table, everybody signs the paper three times, the president says nice words about both of his colleagues, Begin said nice things about Sadat, Sadat said nice things about Begin. Maybe that's his zechut, why he's living so long, Kara. They all died. Begin died and Sadat got killed. Kara is still ticking. Okay, maybe it's a zechut that he made shalom. But nonetheless, that's the way you look at a peace treaty. Over here, rocks. Okay, rocks, well, they didn't have paper in those days. They didn't have, photographers they didn't have. Tables they had, chairs they had. No, pick up rocks. Yaakov picks up a big monument, he picks up rocks, the kids. And then Yaakov Avinu names the place. Actually, Lavan calls the place Yigar Sahaduta. He names it some Aramaic name, Yigar Sahaduta. Vayaakov karalo Galaed. He calls it Galaed. And then the Pasuk comes along and says, okay, this is going to be the treaty. Yaakov says, ויאמר לבן יעקב, הנה הגל הזה, והנה המצבה, עד הגל הזה, ועדה המצבה. And then the pasuk comes along and says, one of the purposes of this, כי נסתר איש מרעהו. The purpose of this treaty is כי נסתר. Hebrew? Simple meaning is, between me and you, when we are out of each other's sight. Rashi says, ve'lo nir'e ish et ra'ehu. The Mefarshim say that this peace treaty was actually a treaty that what? We're going to separate from each other. And how do you separate? You build a wall. Yaakov Abinu was teaching his children, everybody pick up a rock. I'm going to teach you now how you make a peace treaty with Lavan. You block him. Everybody put a rock and make a tall gal, a tall mound. Yaakov tells his kids, can you see your grandfather now? You can't see him. The wall is blocking. Now we have a peace treaty with this man. This is Yaakov Abinu's lesson for 22 years. He didn't walk into his house. So he's not going to sit at a table with him for a photo op and shake his hand. The peace treaty that you make with Laban, and Laban's very, very tricky, sly. Because what does he name the place? Yigal Sehaduta. Already wants to name it Aramaic. He wants to already influence the children with a different language. He doesn't want them to speak Lashon HaKodesh. Even there, he couldn't wait to, even a little interaction with Laban, already he introduces Yigal Sehaduta. V'Yaakov karalo Galaed. Yaakov says, don't listen to this guy. We don't call it Yigal Sehaduta. We don't speak that language. We call it Galaed. So you see that Yaakov Abin was vigilant when it came to keeping the borders and the boundaries and the separation between him and who he felt would be a threat to his family. I'd like to make an observation. The Achamim say that this Gal'ed was also the place that we read in Tanakh, Gil'ad. Gil'ad, Gal'ed, it's the same area, or has the same, it's referenced the same. There's a midrash that's written by Hanukkah. You know, the Greeks, they were involved in assimilation, trying to assimilate us. They broke all the walls. I know Hanukkah is behind us, but you see, we're still in Galut Yavam. Didn't I tell you that all the Galuyot repeat themselves? So I know you lit the menorah, you ate a few jelly donuts, you spun the dreidel, but we didn't get out of Galut Yavam, I'm sorry. We got out of the original Galut Yavam, but in the universal Galut Lavan, we're still in. Assimilation rate in the United States is over 80%. You ladies are in the 2 out of 10. You're in the 20%. But outside of this room, the hitbolelut, the assimilation is great. And that was what Yavan did. Mityavnim, they abandoned Judaism and they intermarried and they assimilated and they abandoned the Torah way of living. Until the Hashmonaim came. Again, the family of Hashmonaim were traditional. But there's an interesting midrash. The midrash says that before the Hashmonaim went on their war to beat the Greeks, they went to a certain place and they made a prayer. The Megale Amukot, I have it here, in number 66, he writes, Shebanav shel Hashmonaim halku lahar Gilad vitpalelu sham. And they prayed there. Very strange. Why would they go there? I mean, you know, when we go to Israel, we go to the Kotel, we go to the Ma'arat HaMachpelah. Nobody ever says, oh, don't forget to go to Gal'ed, you know, make a tefillah in Gal'ed. What's Gal'ed? Where is it even? Even the best tour guide maybe doesn't know where Gal'ed is. And they go to Gal'ed. Now I know the answer. Because since the Greeks, they broke the wall, and Klal Yisrael went out of bounds. They crossed the line, and they got too close to the Greek culture. And they were in the gymnasiums with them, and they were in the universities with them, and they were in the theaters with them, in the Colosseums, and they started to become like the Greeks. Well, if you want to pray to God to create separation, where's the best place to go? The best place to go is to Gal'ed. You go back to that spot where Yaakov Abinu introduced the way to preserve the Jewish home, and that's by putting a wall, by putting a barrier. That place for what the Hashmonaim were trying to accomplish is the most suitable place to make that tefillah. You're going back to the place where the original Gal'ed, where the original rocks and the walls were established to separate us between Laban. I'd like to say something else, once already we're on this point. I'd like to say that when the holiday is over, and now the rabbis are deciding how we're going to celebrate this holiday. So they could have celebrated Hanukkah in one of two ways. If I was on the rabbinical council at the time, I might have told them, well, listen, we won a war over here, and maybe we should celebrate it, make some type of military parade, or some type of, you know, acknowledgement to the war. They decided to celebrate it using the oil, specifically olive oil. And till today, we light the menorah for that. And the Hachamim tell us is because one property that we know about oil, that it doesn't mix with anything. As a matter of fact, there's an old custom, even by menorah, I don't have the custom, but some people do, that on purpose, they add a little water on the bottom of the cup, and then they add the oil on top. Maybe they're doing it to conserve oil, but how much oil are you conserving? It's not really worth your time. Maybe they're doing it so that the cup doesn't burn, meaning it gets very hot maybe and it'll explode. Maybe they're doing it as a fire hazard. I'm not sure, the cup still gets just as hot. Water also gets hot. But I think that they do it is in order to show in the cup that separation. They want it to be evident that you see oil is on the top and that the water is on the bottom and they don't even mix at all. And that's why the Hakamim wanted us to use oil in order to hint to us that that's Klal Yisrael. And that was the whole problem why we needed a miracle. Because when Klal Yisrael forgot that we're oil and they thought that we're just another, you know, liquid that can mix, so we got into trouble. So the celebration is done as such. Now, I also will tell you the following. I know this because this was my bar mitzvah parasha. It's in Parashat Ekev in the summer. So in that parasha, Moshe Rabbeinu is reviewing the danger that we were in when we were in the desert. He's telling them, oh, this is the end of his life. Oh, you don't know the danger that we were in, and Hashem saved us. So what does he say? He says in the Pasuk, I took you into the desert. And what's in the desert? Nahash. Very good. Nahash, Saraf, Ve'akrav, Ve'tzimma'on, Asher en bo mayim. He said, we went to a place that had four different dangers. Nahash is the snakes. Nahash Saraf, fiery serpents, it's also a danger. Akrab is the scorpion. Bitzimaon, we went to a place that's arid, dry, no water. Comes the Midrash and says, these four dangers in the desert represent the four galuyot, the four exiles. Nahash Zubabel, Saraf, Zuparasumadai, Akrab, Zuyavan. And I wondered, Akrab is a scorpion. Why would Malchut Yavan, which by the way we're experiencing now, Malchut Yavan, the assault against the Jewish home, the assault against the Jewish family, the assault against Jewish values, that's what Yavan was doing. They were coming to reinterpret our sechel, our brains, our hashkafa, azaka azaka berucha, culture. She says she's right. So the question is, why would that be called akrav? Akrav's a scorpion. I found over here what the Zohar Kadosh writes. The Zohar Kadosh in Tikkuni Zohar, and daf mem bet amud bet. Ela akrav. What is akrav? Ihi akar bet. The akrat benta de shchinta. The Zohar HaKadosh says, if you take the word akrav, the first three letters of akrav is akar. You know what akar means? La'akor. To uproot. To uproot what? What's the last letter of akrav? Bet. Well, how do you spell a bet? Bet yutaf. What does that spell? Bayit. The Zohar HaKadosh says, akrab is akar bayit. And that's why when the Torah wants to hint to us, galut yavan, nahas sarab akrab. The akrab is akar bayit. Wanted to uproot the Jewish home. And of course we see already the damage that this akrav had and still has in our time. Well, we continue.
That's the fourth point that you said after akrav.
Akrav, akar, bayit. The uprooting of the house, the bet is spelled bet yutaf, bayit. Oh, the Shekhinah, the Shekhinah. That's the Zohar. You look at the Zohar. I can't explain you everything. And the Zohar says it over there. All right, ladies, if I can have your attention for another minute, I'd like to present to you a Talmud Yerushalmi. I always get excited when I take out this set of Yerushalmi. There's a member in our Shi'ud on Thursday night. His daughter was having a hard time conceiving, and he came to me for a blessing. I said, I don't give blessings. Go to a, you know, I got to go to a tzaddik. Okay, then give me an advice. Okay, you're not paying me for the advice, so it's the advice is going to be based on, you know, you get what you pay for. I'm not an advisor either. Anyway, I told him, donate books. There's a big sigula that if you donate books to the yeshiva, that it brings to fertility. So, okay, what books does the rabbi need in the yeshiva? I said, we need a Jerusalem Talmud. So, he came the next day, I give him credit, and he presents me this Jerusalem Talmud. In the beginning of the book, we actually printed the Zera Haya V'Kayama, that it should be for the fertility, and we put the names of the couple. And they were infertile for many years. And he came to the door a few months after he donated the books. And he cries, it was children, right? And he starts crying and he says, it worked. And he said, it's an amazing miracle. It's not a miracle, but the Hakamim tell us. So anyway, whenever I use the book, I'm reminded of that... of that great miracle that happened. So maybe we'll read from it, and they'll continue to have more children. You know, there's a pasuk that says, you must have learned this in school, Eres chita uschora vegefen utena verimon. Eres zeshemen udvash. It rings the bell. It's the pasuk that talks about the seven fruits or species of Eretz Yisrael. In school, they used to tell us the order. This comes before this, and this becomes before that, etc. Actually, we're learning that in the shul now, in Siman Resh, Reshid Aleph, and Shulchan Aruch. Anyway, the rule is that whichever word is closer to the word Eretz, that is more significant than the other item. So, for example, Eretz Chita, or Chita's wheat. So therefore, chita is the wheat. We, that's the most important, chita. And then you have se'ora, gefen, te'ena, rimon. But then it says the word eres again. Eres, zet shemen. Now the rule is, anything that's next to the word eres is important. So zet shemen is an olive. So it comes out that the two most important things in this pasuk, out of the seven, is chita, which is next to the first eres, and Zet Shemin, which is next to the second edit. Now look at this. You're learning Yerushalmi. I guarantee you, your husbands don't know this Yerushalmi. This Jerusalem Talmud. Yesterday they made a siyum for the Talmud Babli. But they didn't make a siyum for Talmud Yerushalmi. You know, he might know the Babli, but he doesn't know this Yerushalmi. So you're learning something now that most people don't know. It's in Bikurim. Empirically shown. It's in Ot. On halacha gima. Velama ketiv eretz eretz shne pa'amim. Why did it say in the pasuk eretz twice? Lehodi'acha she'en habayit omed ela al shne devarim halalu. That the house does not stand only on these two things. Chita and Shemen. I don't know what Jewish home stands on these two things. So there's a rabbi called Rabbi Eliyahu Fulda. He wrote a Pirush on Yerushalmi. Our great rabbi Rav Chida knew about this rabbi. He writes about him in Shema Gedolim. He says, V'shama'ati ozni, my ears heard, Mehagadlut shel shekedato ukdushato. That the author was a great shakdan and a great kadosh, diligent rabbi with holiness. What does he say? Sheikar tzorche habayit hu pat v'shemen. He learns it very simply. The main ingredients that the lady needs to run a home, you need flour, which is hita, and shemen. And shemen is oil. Okay, that's interesting. Gemara, it's telling me the grocery list that they did a survey that when the person lady goes shopping, the number one item is hita, and the number two item is shemen. Okay, and therefore the Gemara says a home cannot stand without. Now I cannot. Listen, I accept the simple explanation, but I cannot accept that that's what the Gemara is coming to tell me. The Gemara is coming to tell me now what the most popular products that a lady goes to buy in order to establish a home. And today what? Today it's going to be what, Cheerios and coffee? We're going to change it? So I saw a exceptional chiddush from the Baba Rebbe. May live and be well. And he said the following, based on what we're learning today. We're talking about over here what the Gemara refers to, She'en habayit omed ela ashne devarim halalu. We're not talking about products. The Gemara is not going into the pantry of the Jewish home. The Gemara wants to know what's the foundation of a Jewish home. The Zohar Kadosh says, if you take the numerical value of the word hita, het, tet, and he, het is 8, and tet is 9, and that's 17, and then he is 5. 22, very good. Well, you know what else has 22 letters? The Hebrew alphabet. And therefore, the Torah is compared to hita. Hita is 22 keneged the chat bet otiyot of the Torah. Shemin Zayit, we know what it is already. Shemin Zayit represents the separation. The fact that Klal Yisrael doesn't mingle and doesn't mix with the Goyim. And therefore the Gemara is telling you the key of the Jewish home is Hita v'Shemin Zayit. The key of a Jewish home is the study of Torah, is Torah education, is the study in the yeshivot, is the learning, hita, the 22 letters, and shemen. That's why those two come to the, next to the words eretz. To establish an eretz, to establish a country. Well, a country is established by homes. You can't establish a country before you establish homes. The homes of that country must be eretz hita and eretz zet shemen. By the way, that answers another question to me. Why didn't the pasuk just write eretz zet? I mean, we're talking about the olives. But it says, no, what type of olive? Zet shemen. What does it have to mention the shemen for? The fruits of Eretz Yisrael are the olive. The explanation is because it's hinting to us that for the Jewish home, it's zet shemen. It's the olive that comes out, which represents the olive of separation and insulation from the outside world. The two most important ingredients in the Jewish home, Hita v'shem and Zayit. And the Greeks, incidentally, all right, I don't mind getting picked on. You know, some rabbis, when they speak in front of me, so they get up and say, and now I'm going to say a gematria in honor of Rabbi Mansour. As if I'm the one that made up this concept of gematrias. So they're trying to say, oh, this is like his invention. So to make him feel good, you know, I'll make up a gematria and all that. I don't know why they seem to pick on me as if I'm doing something that's not traditional. The gematria already is the basis of many interpretations of the Zohar Kadosh. They use the gematria. It's one of the very important ways to... Now, I agree. The reason why people do not appreciate gematria is because if a rabbi would just come along and say, oh, this equals this, and this equals this, and this, then it has no flavor. Gematrias are only valuable after you give a half-hour introduction, and then you say, oh, by the way, this equals that. You say, that's a... So I don't think people know how to use it correctly. Therefore, they don't... It doesn't have the punch that it's supposed to have. Well, now that I spoke for more than a half hour, I could tell you that if you take the words hita and shemen, which is the basis of a Jewish home, the Yerushalmi says, well, hita is 22. And Shemen is 390. Chita Shemen. That, of course, equals 412, which is the exact numerical value of the word Bayit. Bet, Yud, Taf. Bayit, Gematria, Chita, and Shemen. Now that's a great Gematria, because that's reminding you that a Bayit is understood. And now we understand what the Greeks were doing. Akar Bayit. Leshakeham Tonatach. They were trying to take us away from the Chita. That's probably why we eat jelly donuts, because Chita, it's made of Chita, it's made up of the wheat. I can't explain the jelly, I can explain the donut part of it. And of course, Shemen. Shemen is the Shemen side of the menorah. They were going after the Bayit, Gematria, Shemen, Chita. Well, in conclusion, ladies, I go back to that great, great story of Yehuda, that Yaakov Abinu sent him down, Goshna. Well, let me tell you something about that town. We don't know too much about it, but we know the Jewish people lived in that town. That's where the ghetto was. That's where the Jewish settlement was in Egypt, in Goshen. And the Pasuk writes in one of the plagues, in Parashat Va'era, Vifleti Bayom Ahu et Eres Goshen, God says in the Pasuk in Va'era, Perek Chet Yud Chet, I'll read the English for you. And on that day I shall set apart the land of Goshen, Asher Ami Omed Aleha, where my nation lives. Makat Arov, the plague of Arov was wild animals. It's not going to go to Goshen. When the wild animals came into Egypt, it's one of the plagues. Arov was a mixture of animals. God says, it's not coming to Goshen. One of the Sefarim HaKedoshim reads this pasuk differently and says like this, Vifleti bayom ahu et eres Goshen. God says, I'm going to separate and protect the city of Goshen. You know why I'm going to separate them and protect it? Asher ami omed aleha. My nation lives there. Lebilti hiyot sham arov. There is no mixture. The Jews are to themselves. They're oil. They're not mixing with other cultures and foreign ideologies. The arov of here is not only referring to the makat arov. It's referring to the Jewish people. Lebilti hiyot sham arov. In Goshen there was no arov. There was no mixture. There was no, 50% Jewish and 50% Egyptian culture. Was nothing. Lebilti hiyot sham arov. No additives. No extras. And that's what Yaakov Avinu was interested in. He knew that the Jews, when they go down to Egypt, they're going out to four exiles. And therefore he had to establish the principle that Goshen represents. Goshen represents separation. And therefore he sends Yehuda. Yehuda of course represents Mashiach ben David. He sends him to Yosef, which represents Mashiach ben Yosef, which represents, he was already preparing the redemption. But he says, if we're going to get out of these four galuyot, Galut HaGuf, Galut HaSecher, Galut HaNefesh, and this one that's called Galut HaKol, it must begin with the principles of Goshen. That the Jews have to live to themselves. Now in Egypt it might have been easy. But guess what? Sometimes we're going to have to live like Yaakov lived, right next door to Lavan. But like Sefer Hasidim said, you're not going to be able to walk into his house. Now I said to myself, if that's the lesson, of Goshen, the lesson of Goshen is insularity, to be insular, to be alone, not to allow the foreign influences to creep in under the door. If that's the case, I will conclude with explaining a custom that we have on Hanukkah. They take a dreidel, they call it. It's like a toy that spins. You know what a dreidel is? Dreidel means to spin, yes? It's Yiddish for spinning, no? Sevivon. And they spin it. And I'm not a proponent of this, but the kids, they play for money. I don't think it's a good practice necessarily. But they bet on which letter the dreidel will fall on. And they say, Nes Gadol Ayasham. Although I don't know who decided to put those letters necessarily on the dreidel, but that's the custom. And the explanation they tell us is that each one of those letters represents one of the exiles. The letters on the dreidel actually, Nes Gadol Haya Sham, is the same letters of Goshna. It's hinting the four exiles. The coming and spinning the dreidel, that reminds us that Klai Yisrael is going to spin throughout its history, and we're going to land one time in Nun, Galut HaNefesh, another time Gadol, Guf, another time Haya, that's Galut HaKol that we're in, Sham. Sham is Galut HaSechel, which is the last one, which is Yavan. The four Galuyot are hinted in this over here. But in the dreidel also is hinted, don't forget the lesson of Goshna. The reason why Yavan had a hand on us is because we entered their zone. We entered their territory, mentally and physically. And as a result, we lost our identity. The Goshna lesson is that Libilti Hiyot Sham Arov. The Klai Yisrael succeeds when there's no Arov, when there's no mixture. And that's what the Greeks were trying to do. Akar Bayit, Akrav. And therefore, if by letting in the culture into the Jewish home it destroys it, then by keeping it out, that establishes it. And that's what the Yerushalmi means. That En Habayit Omed, Ela al Chita b'Shemen. Chita is the commitment to the study of Torah, and Shemen is the commitment to pure Jewish values without any dilution and any change. I'd like to conclude with one more word. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avot, Shimon HaTzadik haya mishiyare Knesset HaGedola. Hu haya omer, Ashlosha devarim haolam omed, al haTorah v'al haAvodah v'al gemilut chasadim. He said the world stands on three principles: Torah, Avodah, Gemilut Chasadim. Torah is the study of Torah, Avodah is Tefillah and Emunah, and Gemilut Chasadim is acts of kindness. I would just like to make one fast observation, although it deserves a class on its own. The Mishnah said, "Ashlosha devarim haolam omed." The word is omed on these things. If I was writing the Mishnah, I might have used the word kayam, which also means exists. Omed is to stand. Well, I guess you could say the world is standing. It's not a human being, doesn't have legs. But okay, you could say the world stands. However, I'd like to explain it. The word omed is used in a context when we talk about another word, holech. Holech means to move. Omed means to remain stagnant. Now, if I were to ask you, what is it better? Is it better to be an omed or a holech? Right. You always answer it depends. You can always be right if you answer it depends. See, these ladies, they committed right away. Always say it depends. Well, I'll tell you why you answered quickly like you did, because you always heard us say, in Judaism you have to be holech, moving and going, but don't be omed, don't be stagnant. However, in society today, we see the world as holech. From a technological standpoint, today's inventions make yesterday's inventions archaic and antique. The world is moving very fast, scientifically, advances in all the different knowledges and secular knowledge. The world is moving at a rapid pace. Clearly, there's advancements and there's changes every day. They tell us we're living in a modern world. Modern already, this year is considered modern compared to last year, based on that's how fast it's moving. The world is holech. But I'm sorry to tell you that there are some people that believe that the Torah should also be holech. After all, they come along and say, well, if everything is changing and everything is being upgraded, so we have to modernize our Torah as well to keep up with changing times. And therefore we need to adjust it. And therefore we need to, advance it. We must make some amendments and some changes. After all, when the Torah was written so many years ago, it applied to that generation. But today, it must evolve. It must evolve into something that's more relevant, something that's more pertinent, something that's more current. Once in a while, they send us on our phones an upgrade. So our Torah also should receive upgrades from time to time. And so should our avodah, our tefillot, and so too our way that we do chesed. The Mishnah comes along and says that although everything else in this world, in the secular place, is holech, ashloshah devarim, there are three things that must be omed. Omed means they must stand in place and cannot tolerate any change. They must be durable and enduring and remain in position stationary. Torah does not change. Avodah does not change. And Gimlut Chesed does not change. It must be, if the Torah is to protect the world, it must be a Torah that's omed. Not a Torah that's holech. The Greeks, they wanted to come along and change the Torah. They said, you have to move it up. You have to translate it into Greek. They wanted it to be a holech. You know what happens when a Torah is holech? Klai says holech also. Holech to the other side. Holech to assimilation. And therefore, our Torah comes along in the prayer. The pasuk comes along and says that the Hashmonaim, the Bet Hashmonai, they came along and they had the tradition. They had the tradition of the true Mesorah. And therefore they established not something that was new that the Greeks introduced. They actually reestablished something that was very, very ancient and very old. And that's a very important lesson as well. That when we introduce chita, today it is gluten-free. Today they don't want any chita. Today they figured out a way to do away with chita. That's a sign of the times. You know, when the society talks about gluten-free, they're trying to change what a chita looks like. Well, maybe in a diet it's good. But in religion, gluten-free is not good. In religion, we must commit ourselves to the original form of chita. But it only works when we have on the list of errands shemen zayit as well. And then be'ezrat Hashem, the Jewish home is built on strong foundations. And that's the secret of Yaakov. Don't forget that the Jews came out of Egypt because of Goshna. The Bilti Hiyot Sham Arov.